Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. His latest report, a 40-minute documentary on the tribal fratricide in the world's newest country, South Sudan, goes up Monday on Vice.com, and it is also featured in the entire issue of this month's Vice magazine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hey, Ian, how you doing?
Good. So in terms of what's going on with South Sudan, the world's newest country that's been involved in fratricide and, of course, resulted after decades of war with its northern neighbor, Sudan, Kerry visited there recently, got an agreement from South Sudan's President Salva Kiir, which was then subsequently broken. Now the United States got a deal to end the fighting, which was subsequently broken. And now the U.S. has imposed sanctions not on the leader and the rebel leader, but on the commander of the government's Presidential Guard Force and the military leader of the rebels. And this is ahead of a meeting that's going to take place under the auspices of the president of Ethiopia on Friday. Do you think there's a chance of a real ceasefire? These guys don't seem to be particularly reliable.
No, I mean, what you're hearing on the news is a completely different story than what's actually happening on the ground. The word I hear a lot is verge and on the almost, you know, beginning and whatever. But just so you know, the rebel faction, which is the newer tribal element led by Dr. Riek Machar, controls half of the country and will control most of the oil-producing and also income-producing areas in the north. So he has no reason to sit down with Salva Kiir because Salva Kiir has no source of income.
And Salva Kiir basically has the capital, but that's about it, right?
That's where the bills are. So he can't pay his bills because he's got something like 750 generals on the payroll, and about 200,000 to 400,000 troops, depending what day it is.
So, but isn't there an element of manipulation from the north, the traditional enemy of the south?
Yeah, so, I mean, just so the listeners understand, I mean, I spent a month in country with Dr. Riek Machar and also with the rebels, and I was very intrigued as what was the mechanism behind this, because it's unusual for a country that has been around for 3 years to suddenly just boom, almost overnight, split. And what I saw was the same old, same old. And when I wrote this 130-page article, it is a repeat of South Sudan's history, you know, of people being manipulated by outsiders, in this case Ethiopia and, of course, Khartoum, Sudan, to get that oil. So the Nuers, who are the second largest tribal unit, immediately fell into the old tribal war against the Dinkas. But the Nuers actually sit on the areas that have oil. So Dr. Machar, being sort of abused by Kiir for 2 to 3 years and being fired as vice president, basically said, screw it, you know, we're just going to we'll duke this out and see who wins.
But in the meantime, thousands of innocent civilians have been killed and a million have been displaced.
Right, and this is the extraordinary thing about being with a rebel leader who has a PhD. And I spent a week sitting under the trees chitty-chatting and talking about books and democracy. And you know, he's one of the old Marxist school type rebel leaders. He did this exact same thing in 1991, and which led to this extraordinary famine that killed somewhere between 100 to 150,000 civilians. And when I was there, there was no food. We had to shoot animals or we had to catch fish to live on. And that was the dry season when food is plentiful. And, of course, now the rainy season is starting. And he was not concerned at all about the potential disaster or the famine that was about to befall the country. And I still to this day can't figure out how one person could launch, or two people, let's call it that, launch an entire country into civil war.
Well, but clearly these tribal divisions must be real. They're tapping into something, aren't they? I thought that there were tribal wars before South Sudan was formed.
Of course. And you keep in mind that the original war was, you know, the Arab North, you know, the old slavers, Islamic sort of driven philosophy against the southern Christian animist black tribes. And then when they signed this peace agreement, the idea was to share this oil, which was sort of smack in the center of both of these countries. But the two tribes have sort of a lot of, I don't know, it's not that serious because they actually live together and they're fairly similar. But what happens is that Selvik here, who is John Garang's number two, started packing the government with friends and Dinkas and then pushing out the Nuers. And it became very obvious when he fired Riek Machar that he was going for the whole enchilada and not sharing it with this tribe. And it broke down to such an extent that he, Selvik here, tried to kill Riek Machar by sending a tank over to his house to blow it up and ended up killing a number of his assistants. But this tribal thing happened in a day. In other words, on December 15th, when they told the presidential guard to disarm, over 2 days they killed over, some estimate, up to 10,000 Nuers. And this were the Dinka militias running around asking people in their language, Dinka, and if the person didn't understand, they would kill them. And that electrified the entire country and made all the Dinka and Nuer flee to these UN camps. So within 2 days, the country fell apart.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. His latest report, a 40-minute documentary on the tribal fratricide in the world's newest country, South Sudan, goes up on vice.com on Monday, and it's also featured in the entire issue of this month's Vice magazine. So, Robert Young Pelton, this is all about oil, though, apart from tribal animus and jockeying for power and boneheaded maximalist moves on the part of the new leader of Sudan. So talk to us about this oil, because it's always been paradoxical that the oil's largely in the south or on the border. However, the pipelines go through the north to the Red Sea. And my understanding is that there are plans to have the pipelines go south through Kenya, which would cut the north out. So it's pretty hard to believe that the north doesn't have a stake in this fight.
Right, you're exactly right. And typically I back off of theories that it's all about the oil. But in this case, it is exactly all about the oil. And much of the fighting ever since Sudan achieved its independence in the 50s is about controlling the areas where oil might be found. And George Bush actually told the leader of Sudan that his spy satellites had seen some oil deposits and would they like to talk to Chevron. That began in the late 70s and the 80s, and that's when the war intensified. That's when the last civil war took off. And essentially what the North tries to do is clear these, they're not nomads, they're pastoralists, but, you know, the cattle herders and the farmers off of this area so they can't lay claim to it, and then they start the oil drilling. And then, of course, the troops that the North hires are very indisciplined and sort of, I guess, a rabble, for lack of a better word. And then they pushed them out. And what happened is, finally Sudan said, okay, enough, let's share the oil. You drill the oil, and then you send it to us, and we'll charge you $35 per barrel, which is quite a large amount of money, but it's sort of reparations, if you will. And then what happened was Salva Kiir and people like that started talking to people like Eric Prince and decided they would build a refinery, which would allow the oil to go not only south to Kenya, but also over to Ethiopia as a refined product.
Wait a minute. Eric Prince, just for the benefit of the audience, he's the head of Blackwater, right, the mercenary group, now called Xi.
Former head, and now he works for a Chinese company, and he has a number of investments in Africa. And, you know, he's a smart person. He saw this opportunity, and he said, well, if you're paying $35 a barrel to send it north, why don't you just refine it here, and then you can sell it for a higher amount and send it through Ethiopia and south. And that makes perfect sense, except the North didn't like that idea because they have a refinery and they have obviously a budget that requires, you know, a certain amount of oil to flow north.
But the fields themselves initially were developed by the Chinese, weren't they?
Yeah, they, well, they still are. So you have a very good quality of oil coming out of the ground. And originally it was companies that tried to drill for this oil, but they got so much heat, like Lundin and other country companies had to hire mercenaries to protect themselves and ultimately ended up hiring locals as mercenaries. They took too much heat from the international community, so they brought in peristatal companies, which are owned by government. So the Chinese have the majority share. The Malaysians are in there. And then that allowed them to abuse the local people and not take the heat. When South Sudan became independent, it was dependent upon them shipping the oil north and generating X amount of dollars, not just for South Sudan, of course, but also for North Sudan.
So at this point, then, you've got Eric Prince in there suggesting both a refinery and a pipeline. That's no easy undertaking, is it, a pipeline? Who's going to finance that?
Well, the pipeline is being financed separately, but the root cause of this most recent war was the Nuers feeling like they were not getting the full benefit of this oil. And there's two refineries in there, and one is already working, and one was supposed to come online in the northern part. And this would have generated millions of dollars in income and then actually be sold back to the government so they can generate more money. That refinery itself would generate hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's not unusual for African countries to be overthrown for natural resources. It's unusual that a country like South Sudan, which had so much focus on it from the Bush administration, the Obama administration, nobody saw this. It just happened overnight, and it's all about oil, which we developed.
And to the question of whether the Omar Bashir, the dictator in the north, is manipulating the situation.
Yeah, so what's happening is Eritrea, Nigeria, and Sudan are supplying arms and weapons to the rebels. You know, they airdrop them. Khartoum actually pays for the weapons. Eritrea drops them with their planes. And then there's financial support. And that's allowed these huge mass slaughters that we were part of in places like Malakal and the most recent one in Bentiu. You essentially have over 30,000 illiterate cattle herders, which they call the White Army, which nobody had ever filmed before, in action. And that is probably some of the most horrific things you will ever see in your life, which is anywhere from 12-year-olds up to 70-year-olds taking revenge on the opposing tribe with spears and machetes and machine guns and RPGs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a horrible, horrible war.
And this is what you've documented and what you witnessed.
Correct. And this was something that I wanted to get in on because the White Army was supposed to be mythical. It had never been filmed before in action, and there was some type of... The army is actually brought to action by prophecy. And there's a prophet in South Sudan called Nunbeng who will prophesy that a man without scars who is left-handed will rule the country. And that, of course, is Riek Machar. And then Machar uses those prophecies, but the army won't go into action until the prophet says, okay, attack now. And we were there for the first major attack on the oil town of Malakal on the White Nile. And it is an extraordinary thing to see.
Well, just briefly, what happened?
Well, what happens is they mass. They're small groups of cattle herders and ex-soldiers, and they gather their weapons, they gather material, their spears, and then they just charge. They just run as fast as they can, shooting as many bullets as they can. And the people that are guarding are typically not from there. They're government soldiers. They're either hired out of the Blue Nile group or the Darfurians. And they run because they know they're going to get killed. So the ones that trip or fall or get shot are then speared multiple times in the anus and the buttocks, or they're burned alive, or their arms and legs are chopped off. And then they start burning down the town and looting it. And it is literally a scene out of Dante, which you'll see in the documentary.
And does this include women and children who don't escape, or do they manage to escape?
Well, typically what's interesting is because of the first attack, in Juba, in December 15th, most of the women and children fled to the UN camps. And these camps, which were just set up as aid distribution centers, suddenly became cities of 60,000 people. So they were all walked in the camp. And, of course, there's some casualties. But there were a number of dead civilians. So the town we were in had a population of 129,000. And I think we saw maybe a couple of hundred dead civilians that were just older people that just, for some reason, didn't leave. So the women and children are not slaughtered en masse. You have heard stories, and there are events where they go into hospitals and they kill everybody, or they'll go into a mosque and kill everybody. But they're all hiding at the UN camp.
So when Secretary of State Kerry describes this in terms of these sanctions on these two, as these are individuals responsible for perpetrating unthinkable violence against civilians, it's odd, isn't it, that he's sanctioning the military guy, Peter Gadet, and on the rebel side, and Mariel Chen Yuong, I guess.
right. Here's the thing I don't understand. Peter Gadet is a well-known person there. I was with Peter in the bush in February, and he left the government. In other words, just before independence, you know, a lot of generals broke off with their armies. And Peter Gadet's a very smart guy. He's got business relationships with Jarsh and other investors there. So he threw in, because he's newer, with Riek Machar, and he pulled the card to attack Bentiu, which is the big oil town just north of where I was. He is a smart operator, but he's not the reason for the violence. He's not the one that broke the ceasefire. The person that broke the ceasefire was Salva Kiir, and it didn't help that when he had peace talks, he arrested about 10 of the people who were supposed to be in the peace talks at the Sheraton in Addis. So it's a sham, and I understand that America is upset that, you know, that once again we have this Rwanda-type event occurring. But the only thing that stops these people is understanding the core reason why they're killing each other. They're terrified that they can't, you know, realign themselves along the older sort of Dinka newer friendship. They're just terrified of each other because of these slaughters.
So what's going to happen then on Friday in Ethiopia, assuming that the president, Salva Kiir, shows up and Machar also shows up?
Well, Machar's a little cagey because Kiir, like I said, arrested a number of people and charged them with treason, which didn't make the peace talks go very well last time. Secondly, Machar controls most of the oil area and about half of the country. So unless those peace talks are on a level that he accepts, which is essentially reparations and ceasefires, but I think he's going to do what most people do, is he'll have a guy go there and he'll talk, talk, talk. And meanwhile, they'll be fighting in the bush. You saw what Salva Kiir did when John Kerry flew out and they shook hands and they had all this, knuckle bump bro love for the media about this new breakthrough agreement. And then literally 2 days later, they had the most brutal assault on Bentiu and Nasser. So it's a sham.
Well, Robert Young Pelton, I look forward to seeing your documentary on Monday on vice.com and also reading about it in the issue of the magazine Vice that's out now. Apparently the entire issue is devoted to this story. I thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is a publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. His latest report, a 40-minute documentary on the tribal fratricide in the world's newest country, South Sudan, goes up on Monday on vice.com, and it's also featured in the entire issue of this month's Vice magazine. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about whether a great event such as a threat to the planet from global warming could synchronize the feelings of millions of people to achieve what facts and logic cannot.